Now, what's your basic impression when you watched the Joker trailer, which popped about 2, 3 hours ago?
It's the best trailer we've had so far.
I agree. It's a brilliantly made trailer. I mean, you're always aware that you're watching a trailer when you watch a good one, but I just was totally caught up in it. I mean, I just thought it was so well timed, and so the choices were just exactly right. I was really taken.
Don't you find that it potentially captures the spirit of Joaquin's performance and what to expect?
Yeah, very much. I mean, obviously he's going to be a Best Actor nominee. Who knows? Maybe for the first time, a villain or in a superhero, or basically a superhero based or DC Comics villain as a Best Actor winner. It's pretty amazing. So, I mean, that's going to happen apparently. So, I guess that it's going to happen.
I have no doubt that the performance is going to be great.
Yeah.
It's Joaquin Phoenix, but will the movie be great? That's another question. We'll see. We'll see.
Now, what did you the talk is that this you can't help but think when you're thinking about a guy who's clearly isolated, lonely, feels nothing but pain and drain and depression, haunted, that he's there's an echo of the present day shooter mentality, the people who have been guilty of these horrific slaughters in recently, and it's kind of the same thing. It's like, a guy who has no, there's no connection, there's to anything. He's living completely in his own miserable world. Did you feel a little bit of that when you were watching it, or?
I didn't even think about that, but now I'm gonna think about it because it does capture that type of mentality, right? How you completely disassociated yourself emotionally
Yeah.
with everyone around you to the point where when you commit crimes, you basically have a smile on your face. That's disturbing. And at the same time, we weren't taking this movie so seriously, I find, with the first few trailers, but then it got into these prestigious film festivals, and then the heads of those festivals, like Cameron Bailey from TIFF and
Yeah.
Alberto Barbera from Venice, they were just praising it. And you were like, okay, something's going on with this movie. And now we see this trailer, we're like, okay, we kind of see what they're saying. There's this dread and this creepiness lurking throughout that I don't think was necessarily in the script, which we both read.
Yeah.
The direction looks really good from Todd Phillips, and it goes to show how a performance can totally elevate even the most middling of screenplays, because I thought the screenplay was pretty average.
Yeah, I didn't. I'll tell you, I didn't think transformative. I didn't think, "Wow, this is really pops up, leaps off the page." It struck me as a sturdy, kind of almost Death Wish like. He was. You knew that he was going to pop, and he was getting angrier and more miserable and more lonely. And those awful Wall Street guys who taunt him on the subway. That was a but I felt that it was familiar, and I'm sensing as you are agreeing that Phoenix and I guess Todd Phillips together, they came up with something that made it larger and more vivid in terms of the performance. So.
Yeah, the trailer seems to almost have us sympathize with him.
Yeah.
Which I guess is the goal. It's going to be quite interesting to watch a movie where we sympathize with a psycho. I mean, I think what Todd Phillips is trying to do here, he's trying to show us the most realistic depiction possible of the man kind of losing a grip of reality in himself, which is a horrifying thing to see, and it's something that we don't usually see in comic book movies.
Yeah.
And obviously, the Heath Ledger performance in The Dark Knight is something that has become legendary,
Yeah.
and so Phoenix to decide to tackle it is quite bold and ambitious. be a better Joker performance than Heath Ledger's. But I don't know now. This could be just as good.
You know, when you think of the life of Yeshua of Nazareth, otherwise known as Jesus Christ, he's a man who basically, I guess the word would be, you know, marinated for 30 years. He didn't really become who he was until he hit age 30. And for 3 years, he preached and walked the earth and, you know, collected disciples and came to his tragic end at age 33. With Joker, we have a guy who marinated for 45 years before, because it's unusual to see an origin story about a guy who played by a guy who's in his mid-40s and who, frankly, because of all the cigarette smoking and everything, he looks like a you know, guy who takes care of himself, but he obviously looks about 50. So it's unusual to see an origin story for a guy who's as well along, you know, at the half-century point in his life. That's the only thing that stopped me about the whole thing, but I guess I can get past it.
Yeah, well, how old is Joaquin? He's probably
45, 46, but he looks older because he smokes all the time.
He's gone through a very, he's gone through some real tragedies in his life with losing his brother, and then he had that whole, I would call it a mental breakdown. He had some kind of mental breakdown in the late aughts, early, you know, with the Letterman performance, and I don't know. He just strikes me. And by the way, he's one of my very, very favorite actors working right now. I mean, he just strikes me as this totally unpredictable guy that expect the unexpected with him. And even in interviews, he seems quite really shy.
Yeah.
And I mean, he's just such a brilliant guy. But have you ever spoken to him?
Sundance a couple of times, but I wouldn't call it anything like a conversation. You know, just, you know, glancing chit chat stuff. You know, nothing to. The longest conversation I ever had with him was way back when I was talking to him about that really excellent. Oh boy, it's a wow. Now I have to go and remember. Oh man, having this blank thing. But there was this excellent fight scene that he was in that I thought was one of the most brilliantly choreographed, realistic-looking fight scenes I've ever seen. And he told me that he had gone to some considerable effort to try and deliver, you know, just an extra level of realism and naturalism in the performance. I remember I was talking to him during the press at Toronto for Walk the Line, and he was telling me about a James Gray thing that he was in. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, so it must have been, during We Own the Nights, maybe?
Boy, I don't think so. That's the relationship movie. That's kind of the love affair movie. No, it was
that's two lovers. We Own the Night is like a family saga. There's a really good car chases in the movie.
Well, maybe you're right. I don't know why We Own the Night is not sounding like the right film, but
That would come out 2 years after.
The Yards! That's what it was, The Yards.
Okay, yeah.
Mark Wahlberg and Phoenix get into this fight scene, and it's really great. I mean, this is, you know, it's most fights, you've ever witnessed a fight or two in your life, you know, they're clumsy. They're over in like 40 seconds, if that. But this was like a midpoint between what real fights are like and what a movie fight, you know, perfectly choreographed. It was really one of the most brilliant things I've ever done. Anyway, that was what he was proud of that. He said thanks for noticing that, and so that was the one time.
Oh, but, wow!
You know,
yeah, I mean, I've seen The Yard. I don't remember too much about it.
Now you're making me want to find the fight scene.
Yeah.
And highlight it as a thing. Here, one more thing about the Joker thing. As you know, Robert De Niro is playing a established talk show host, kind of like, and I thought it was ironic, it's kind of like the Jerry Langford character in The King of Comedy. And it's interesting that, you know, King of Comedy and Taxi Driver, both with De Niro in the lead, are people who are completely off on their own orbit, sociopathic. And here's De Niro playing, in a sense, a smug, wise-ass Jerry Langford type guy who, you know, regards Joaquin Phoenix's character extremely askance. So.
And Martin Scorsese is producing. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't think they're hiding it at this point,
right.
The parallels between Joker and King of Comedy.
Yeah.
Although it's going to be very hard for Joker to be as good of a movie as King of Comedy, which is just incredible. It's one of Scorsese's best movies, in my opinion. But it's going to be, I think there's going to be a lot of parallels in there between both movies. What do you think?
Yeah, I do, but I'll tell you, when I've tried The King of Comedy 3 times. There was the first time, there was like you know, a couple weeks later, 3 weeks later, and then I re-watched it maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I swear to God, that movie, good as it is, I would never ever call it a less than completely well-made, strong, tough movie, but man, it is so difficult to sit through at times, particularly that scene where they go out to Langford's Long Island mansion, and Langford comes in, and man, that's just one of the, it's a difficult thing to sit through. It's good, but it's not an easy set,
you know. I was going to say, De Niro is very scary in the movie, even though he basically has a smile on his face the entire time. He's completely creepy. In contrast, by the way, and this will be the only time we ever mention this movie, with the latest John Travolta vehicle in overacting, The Fanatic, which I saw last night.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard about this movie?
Remind me of the title, sorry?
The Fanatic.
Oh, The Fanatic. No, I do not know that film.
Directed by Fred Durst of Limp Bizkit fame.
Okay.
This movie is supposed to come out next week, I think.
All right.
But it's just about a great fan that really likes this actor. And Travolta is the stalker. And it's another chance for Travolta to overact. And I mean, this movie just made me appreciate King of Comedy so much more.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, this is almost Gotti level bad.
Well, what way? I mean, it's too invested or underinvested in what sense? What's wrong with it?
Oh well, you know, just like any crazed stalker. Movie. I mean, do you remember The Fan with De Niro and
sure.
And Snipes? Yeah, it's pretty much like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's nothing new being said here. Let's follow the beat by beat narrative of those kind of movies.
Mm-hmm.
Travolta, with every scene, just goes more and more psycho.
Mm-hmm.
He definitely has a peculiar haircut in this movie. It's almost like, actually, he has the same haircut as Jim Carrey in Dumb and Dumber.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what to call that kind of haircut. It's like a mushroom haircut.
it's kind of similar to Timothée Chalamet's Henry V. It's shaved very tight on the sides, kind of a pudding bowl haircut.
It is.
Yeah,
I wasn't impressed by the king the trailer. Were you?
No, they're clearly the idea is to veer away from the eloquence and the Shakespearean tones of the Kenneth Branagh and the Laurence Olivier thing, and to make something more naturalistic and less invested in legend and more, you know, this is the way it really was, that sort of thing. I respect that they're trying to do it in a different way. I'm not dismissive, but I somehow just don't believe. I think it was possibly, I'll put it that way, maybe not the greatest casting thing. I just am having trouble believing in Chalamet as the charismatic, leader of men that Henry V allegedly was. But,
By the way, the King will be at Venice, and the Venice Film Festival just started really late last night, in the wee hours of the morning, at least in terms of our time zones. And
they've got the first review up, which is of the Carreta, the Truth.
Right.
Yeah.
And that first review is positive. So, anyway, we'll have to keep a close eye on Venice, because they're the first one to premiere some titles.
Yeah.
I know that The Truth is today, and Ad Astra is supposed to... Ad Astra and Marriage Story are supposed to be tomorrow.
Right. Okay, that'll be the thing. The thing about Marriage Story that I shared with you briefly is that I have a sense, a feeling that I'm having odd feelings about the ScarJo character. She just seems almost preternaturally combative, and not someone that has it. This is what happens when a marriage falls apart, starts to come apart. All the things that were working well between a couple are, of course, not working anymore. And so it's all kinds of, it's all kinds of sadness, because there's this feeling of betrayal and just ashes in your mouth. But I honestly, she seems like the. I fight with my wife now and then, but I just get the feeling that she's the one that's unhappy, and she's starting the arguments, and she's asking for the divorce. And I get the feeling that Adam Driver's character in Marriage Story is, I don't know, maybe like me on some level, because he's not looking for a divorce, he's looking to kind of just plug along,
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Yeah, before I answer that, I did have someone email me the other day saying, I recently rewatched Kramer vs. Kramer, and I just can't see how Marriage Story could be better than that movie in depicting divorce. And he's like Kramer vs. Kramer did it so masterfully. I mean, what more is there to say? We'll find out what more there is to say in Marriage Story. I do wonder. What will make this a special movie, as the buzz claims it is?
Well, remember, though, that Kramer versus Kramer was really not very invested in the differences and the arguments. And the, it was invested in what Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep's characters were angry about, but it didn't really explore them. And they both got lawyers, and they did play rough in the hearing.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know what to say.
Do you know some people that have seen it? I know two people that have seen Marriage Story. They both loved it.
The emotional current is very strong, and that is why, allegedly, the Netflix team believes that this is their Oscar pony, perhaps more than the Scorsese, the Irishman.
Yeah.
But there's maybe two types of people out there, two types of film lovers. The kind that when they hear a film runs 3 hours and a half, almost 3 hours, exactly 3.5 hours, they get excited. They get, oh, right, what a meal. This is going to be a banquet. I can't wait. And then there's the other people who ostensibly claim to love films, and their first reaction is, oh, God. Whereas the true reaction, as we all know, is that there's no such thing as a good movie that's too long, and there's no such thing as a bad movie that's too short. Right?
Yeah. And I can bet that a lot of the people complaining have no problem binge-watching 8 episodes of Manhunter. So,
yeah.
Since we're living in the binge-watching
age
of cultural entertainment, it's a weird, very weird thing to see people complaining that Martin Scorsese's latest movie, reteaming him for the first time in 25 years with De Niro and Pesci, and then you add Pacino and Keitel, that they're complaining that it's too long. I mean, I guess that's why, you know, you could just watch it on Netflix. I mean, if you have to go to the bathroom, just pause it, I guess, or, you know, but, you know, for cinephiles like ourselves, we want to watch it theatrically, and we're going to make sure not to drink too much before the movie.
Yeah.
And that's about it, you know, not too much coffee, not too much water, you know. But yeah, these complaints are just mundane, I find. They're so mundane. And it kind of confirms my assumption for why I had mentioned this to you before, you know, like in the 90s and the 2000s, we had over a dozen movies from the big studios that went over 3 hours.
Uh-huh.
And this decade, we only have two.
Yeah.
And The Irishman is going to be the third one. So, I mean, it does seem as though attention spans have drastically changed in the age of, you know, smartphones and tablets and such.
You know, you might recall that way back, we're talking a year and a half ago, almost, year and one third, at the 2018 Cannes Film Festival. Scorsese visited and did a kind of a tribute discussion at the Director's Fortnight venue and talked about how he is working with 300 scenes in The Irishman. And, you know, if you look at
the same time that a screenwriter had told me that he was convinced, based on what he had heard, that The Irishman would be a miniseries.
Now, that makes doesn't that make obvious, brilliant sense if you were a Netflix executive? You tell Sir Scorsese, listen, we're obviously releasing this as a film, and it's going to be a standalone film, and then we're going to go theatrical, and then we're going to go to streaming, and, you know. But why not, with all this material, why not make it into a 5-part or 6-part or 7-parter, you know? And then people will see it in a different way, and it's a kind of way of, you know, newly configuring what films are. You know, here's the streaming version that lasts 7 hours, and here's the theatrical. I think it's a beautiful idea.
Yeah, kind of like what Tarantino is doing with The Hateful Eight. Have you heard what he's doing with The Hateful Eight on Netflix?
Actually, no.
He's splitting it into 6 episodes. And he added a bunch of deleted scenes, and now it's a miniseries.
So, when we say 6 episodes, do we mean hour-long episodes, or...?
Yeah, I believe so.
All right.
I mean, right now, details are pretty sparse, but it's supposed to debut on Netflix this year.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see Scorsese doing something like that. I'm actually looking for the Netflix Tarantino thing. It's a 4-episode series with 25 minutes of new content.
Okay.
And each episode is around an hour.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Mm. So I can see Scorsese doing something like that. I'm sure he has a 4-hour cut of the movie.
It just seems so obvious that that's what they should do, you know, offer it as a... It seems so obvious to me.
I think it might happen because Netflix has been doing that. I mean, look at what they did with Doug Liman and Fair Game. They just granted him complete creative control. Just give us your director's cut, and we'll have it in our library forever.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, again, why would we complain that Netflix exists? There are some people out there, cinephiles, that still hate Netflix. I don't know why. I mean, we're seeing big studio completely being monopolized by Disney.
Yeah.
And to have Netflix release adult dramas left and right is really beautiful to see.
Right.
There's no reason to complain about Netflix, and even the, you know, the mediocre theatrical distribution that's going to come with The Irishman. I mean, you're going to have to go to the your local art house to see it. You won't be able to go to multiplex. I mean, what do you think about that?
As someone who's been invested in the theatrical my entire life, I feel one way. And as a person who loves the idea of 6-hour versions of movies on Netflix that I can binge on over a weekend, I love them both. I really do. I mean, there's... I think this is a really... I mean, I've never been so happy with the technical... with the immersion in film that the higher standards, that high def at home. The whole thing is wonderful. I mean, I was so delighted... Just to switch subjects briefly, I was so delighted with how much better... The Apocalypse Now looks on my set than it did when I went to see a screening of it at an IMAX theater. It really looks wonderful, even though I couldn't even play the 4K version for some reason. But it's a wonderful time to be a film buff from a streaming perspective. I was able to watch Gavin Hood's film on the 65-inch last night, and it was perfect, and the sound was great. I mean, I just love it. But it's just—it's really a bountiful time. Did I sidestep your question? Is that not what you wanted me to say?
No, that's exactly what that you've basically said my feelings towards this. I mean, you know, Netflix is taking risks. It's not like they're not taking risks. This year alone, they've. They're releasing The Irishman, and they released Triple Frontier, and High Flying Bird, and The Highwayman, and The Laundromat, and The Marriage Story, and these are movies that don't really get made anymore. Forget about Disney, just by Warner Brothers, really, and Paramount, and Universal, all those franchise hungry studios. So I'm happy Netflix exists, I'm not sure what's going on with Amazon, though, but that's a whole other story. So,
what was your impression of when you first saw Meryl Streep in the Laundromat trailer?
It almost confirmed my suspicions that this could very well be like The Informant, which
the Matt Damon thing.
I see a lot of comedic opportunity in this movie. I don't know. She might very well get a Best Actress nomination, by the way, for this. It just looks like such a playful, abundant role.
I'm so in love, all my life I've been so in love with the kind of humor that Soderbergh gets into when he is in the mood to deliver it, which is that he never, ever tells you out there with your big tub of popcorn in your lap, he never tells you that you're supposed to laugh at this. Either you laugh at it and you get it, or you don't. But nobody ever, does the preening obvious gestures, and he doesn't cut it in a way that says, you are supposed to laugh at this. This is funny. Either you understand or you don't. And I love that integrity in him.
He's really counting, including The Laundromat. Soderbergh's released 11 movies this decade.
Yeah.
And isn't this the decade where he retired?
Say again? I couldn't hear.
This is the decade in which he supposedly retired. And he's released 11 movies. So...
Well, as I said when he first announced it, I said you know, this is going to be, you know, obviously a Frank Sinatra retirement. That means basically you want to recharge and maybe do some painting and do some traveling. And then, you know, what will happen will happen. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think one of the very best movies from this this time period for him was Behind the Candelabra. HBO Liberace movie, which premiered at Cannes, which not a lot of people have seen because it, you know, it premiered on HBO and not in theaters. But he's had so many great ones: The Informant, Contagion. So I'm very much looking forward to The Laundromat, which will be screening at Venice in 3 days, I believe.
Yeah. But not, lamentably, in Telluride.
Supposedly not at Telluride.
Which I'm sorry to hear.
Which, yeah, I'm not sure what happened there. I mean, Telluride's getting most of the big titles, if we want to talk about Telluride. But, I mean, except for The Joker, I think it has all the game-changing titles for the fall. Of course, not counting The Irishman as well, but...
Mm-hmm.
But right now, I mean, I'm writing just a fall overview, and it does seem like the two movies to beat are Marriage Story and The Irishman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And lurking around there trying to join them is Jojo Rabbit, which most people are still puzzled by. We're not really sure how that movie is going to be. But
where do you get the puzzlement thing on Jojo Rabbit? I mean, it's obviously broadly, you know, non-historic. Obviously, a jape. Obviously, you know, not really a film with its feet on the ground. But it's at the same time, it has this conviction apparently that it's there's a. You know, we're gonna do something about Nazism and hate and Hitler and everything that really doesn't need to be pointed out that it's the height of venality and ugliness, and yet it's a satirical target. That's the thing I don't quite get. I mean, really, another a Hitler satire? But is that what you mean by the puzzle, or what do you mean?
Yeah, but I was specifically referring to the way Disney is trying to handle this story, this movie, without causing controversy or even trying to distance themselves from this movie. I'm sure you've heard about that.
Yeah, that's a certain executive said, "My God, this does not fit into the Disney family, as to speak. It's an outlier. It's not our type of movie, et cetera, right?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's supposed to be one of Cameron Bailey's very favorite movies of this year's TIFF.
Okay.
He can't stop raving about it behind the scenes.
Okay.
Right. He knows he has potentially a catch here. You remember in 1998 when Life is Beautiful came out and how, you know, some critics were not impressed at all. That especially due to the fact that it, you know, it put a smiling face on the Holocaust, and it kind of it was a Holocaust comedy. I can see those same type of critics, you know, judging Jojo Rabbit as, you know, being very, you know, not respective of. Of the Holocaust and Nazis and everything that was happening at the time, you know, putting a smiling face on Hitler.
Yeah.
I don't really want to elaborate further on Jojo. I don't want to speculate further on Jojo. I am looking forward to seeing it. I'm just really curious what the reaction will be to this kind of movie. Because right now we're living at a time where we're using terms like Nazism a lot, and we're, you know, bashing them. You know, a movie like this could help in making these terms lose their meaning, which is a very dangerous thing. So I would love to see this movie, and I would love to judge for myself before I you know, I say anything else, but do you have any thoughts on Jojo Rabbit? I mean, I know you're skeptical at the moment about it, but
my thoughts are that I preternaturally at my core. My thoughts are that I'm not impressed by the idea of doing. I mean, I'll take any kind of satire that you want to throw at me, but I just don't get the idea of setting a film in early 40s Vienna with and paying zero attention to making it feel like early 40s Vienna. Why do it? Why not do something that feels like its own thing, that you can believe in? I mean, either, whether we like to hear this or not, it's about investment. You have to believe in the reality of what you're seeing on some level. It has to be so to completely disregard the naturalistic aspects is, at the very least, a curious, I'm not saying wrong or ineffective, but a curious way to do it, for the director to cast himself as Adolf Hitler with his New Zealand accent. Again, it's a curious choice. So this is famous last words, and I'll sound like an idiot if I love it. So I don't know why I'm even going on here. But you know, that's my first reaction is the same as it is right now. I'm suspicious of why it was even made with this completely lack of interest in realism. But that sounds like a clueless thing to say. So let's just drop it. Anyway, let me ask you one thing. You said that the latest big maybe would be the Todd Haynes called Dark Waters, and it's and I thought immediately when they announced because you mentioned this before the announcement of the Focus Features releasing this film on 11/22. That would be a perfect thing to start the buzz on it if they have something at Telluride. So I would hope that that's going to happen. At least that'll be something to pay attention to and then some when I get there.
Although Aaron Thompson did mention that it might not make it there.
When did she say that?
So, maybe 2 days ago. She mentioned it in her Dark Waters release date piece.
Yeah.
Here I have it bookmarked here. She says, and I quote.
Uh-huh.
Where is it?
Yeah.
I mean, she basically. Let's see. Oh my God, where is it? I can't find it for
okay.
some reason. But she did mention that chances are it's just not. Her precise words were, "It's not ready for Telluride."
Okay,
that's her precise words.
Okay.
Whatever.
Not it that, might not be ready, but it is not ready for Telluride. That's how she put it.
Yes, it is not ready for Telluride.
All right.
According to the sources that she's spoken to.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
I really hope you guys get a surprise movie because I always love, Oscar season
right.
to get spiced up a little, but I'm not sure. I don't think Dark Waters is gone. I don't think Little Women is gone.
No.
You told me Ad Astra is probably not going.
Yeah.
1917 is clearly not ready.
No, can't possibly be.
So all we have left is Bombshell, which I have no idea. I mean, that would be a great movie though to premiere at Telluride. I have no idea if that's gonna be there. So
Bombshell, just for those who don't know, it's a recently retitled film. Just explain what Bombshell is.
Yeah, so it's the Roger Ailes.
Right.
Story and the whole Fox News.
And the previous title was what?
Wasn't it Divide and Conquer, or was it Fair and Balance? I completely forgot.
My recollection is Fair and Balance all along.
Fair and Balance, yeah. Divide and Conquer was the Showtime series.
Yeah.
Fair and Balance. So now it's Bombshell. I am.
Right.
I don't really have an opinion on this new title. I do know that it's going to focus on the women. It doesn't really focus on Roger Ailes.
That's a good way to do it, because obviously the Russell Crowe version was an Ailes thing, and this is going to be on the women thing. And I was actually kind of intrigued by the fact that they are in an elevator together. And I really liked the makeup, the way they tried and did a pretty good job of making Charlize Theron look like Megyn Kelly. And, you know, they obviously don't trust each other. It's not even small talk. There's nothing. They're just kind of standing there. So, yeah, it's a good call. Good call. So.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, and also,
yeah,
John Lithgow plays Roger Ailes in Bombshell. And I don't know about you, but I find that Lithgow is probably a better Roger Ailes than Russell Crowe was. I've seen a few episodes of... I didn't finish the series.
Right.
Crowe was good, but I think John Lithgow can really just nail this role.
Right.
So we'll see. Barry Aykroyd is the director of photography for this movie. He's a longtime Paul Greengrass DP. I don't think he's going to use a handheld camera the same like Greengrass does in Bombshell. From the footage we saw, it looks like fairly controlled and composed framing. So there's that. It's quite interesting how we're just seeing all these movies start to that are not going to Venice, Telluride, New York, Toronto, that are just starting to appear with release dates for November and December. There's quite a few of them this year. You know, there's Little Women, there's Bombshell, there's Dark Waters, there's 1917. I mean, there's a lot of there's a lot of stuff that's going to be unseen come November.
Right. That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
Let me ask you as a concluding thought or the meditation, if you will. Martel, the head of the jury, the Argentinian director. Lucretia Martel. She basically said she's in the opening press conference at the Venice Film Festival that she was conflicted and troubled about Polanski's film, which is about the Dreyfus case, and it's called An Officer and a Spy, right? And she,
which I hear, by the way, is very good.
He's a good filmmaker. He knows what he's doing. He's never. I mean, I just rewatched the one about the ghostwriter. That's really a good, well-made film.
Yeah, very good movie. Yeah.
Anyway, she said, "Look, I'm dealing with a lot of conflict in my head, and the Hollywood Reporter wants to hang Polanski naturally." And she said, "Listen, I imagine what's going on in my head. Imagine the difficult situation." This is Lucretia Martel speaking. I cannot act as a judge here, however. It's a very difficult situation. We have to take advantage of this festival where all these controversies, the controversies being should a person be canceled or disqualified if they have, criminal or assaultive, problematic history. She believes that Officer and the Spy deserves to have a chance. That obviously means not much of a chance, but she says it deserves to have a chance. And but then you go to the head of the festival, Alberto Barbera, whose viewpoint is one I'll never adopt a quota system that would reduce or lessen the significance and the importance of the Venice Film Festival, and secondly, his view is I am a cinema judge, not an ethical or personal judge. In other words, I'm not a cancel culture person. I am looking only at the film and the film alone, not quotas, not are they a good person, are they a bad person, and the same he believes has to be done by the viewer and the spectators who will see the film. So what's your view on that?
She actually just released a statement to clarify her comments. I'll read it to you.
Where did it appear? In IndieWire, or where did you see the statement?
It was on the playlist.
Okay.
So she starts off by saying, according to some reports after today's press conference, I believe my words were deeply misunderstood. Since I don't separate the work from the author, and I recognize a lot of humanity in Polanski's previous films, I'm not opposed to the presence of the film in competition. I don't have any prejudice towards it, and of course I will watch the film like any other in the competition. Mm-hmm. If I had any prejudice, I would have resigned my duty as the president of the jury. So that's her new statement.
I don't believe that statement, do you?
She's trying to save face.
I mean, she wants to. She said, "Listen, the whole thing of quotas." She said before, is obviously it's difficult and it's never a satisfactory thing. However, we are at this point in history, she believes, and she's right, where in which quotas are, she's quote unquote indeed pertinent for the time being. Do I like them? No. However, I don't think I know of any other system that would force this industry, by which she means paternalistic industry, to think differently and to take into consideration films that are directed by women. She's right, but at the same time, I don't believe in forcing quotas. I know that that's a flawed way to go about it. But she's not wrong in that this is the moment when people are opening doors to women filmmakers in a way that is a good thing. I don't know what to feel. It's two different...
Yeah, I mean, you also have to look at the kind of film festival Venice is. The thing is about quotas, a film festival like Sundance is really drastically different than a Cannes, a Venice, or a TIFF. Sundance having quotas, to me, is a little less problematic than Cannes or Venice, because Sundance does, you know, breed and groom talent.
Mm-hmm.
So it does, in a way, try to lay grounds for the future of cinema in the States, and they want the future to be filled with a lot more female directors. So I understand why Sundance would do that, even though this past Sundance, that kind of mentality was, in my opinion, detrimental to the overall quality of the lineup we ended up getting, which was one of the worst lineups at Sundance in quite some time.
Last January, you're talking about, right?
Last January, yeah.
What did you feel about the one before that, 2018?
The one before? No, the one before that I really liked. Mm-hmm. I really liked the one before that. I just I thought Sundance was on a real roll the last 6-7 years. They really, really were giving us a great lineup. It's just, I mean, just this year that they had an off year. You know, you're allowed to have an off year. Do I think it has to do with the quota that they set forth for in their selection process? I do not know. I don't want to speculate. But the movies overall were very, very disappointing, as you were there as well, and as you can attest. So,
yeah.
So, hey, listen. If this is the direction they want to go to, then so be it. You know, their goal is to, again, groom and breed the future filmmakers in the U.S. And they clearly want it to be very female oriented. And you know what? We can't stop them in doing that.
Mm.
And they just want more inclusivity. And sometimes that'll result in very good movies, and sometimes that'll result in what we have this year. So, that's my take on it. Whereas Cannes and TIFF and Venice, well, especially Cannes and Venice, they basically, their job is to choose the best.
That has to be their job. That can only be their job. Now, that when you say something like that, people believe that you're implying that by choosing, more than a fair number of films by women, that you're allowing less than great films. And that's not the implication that I mean at all. But those people who would say, listen, you've got to have a 50-50 representation, half directed by women, half by men, that is just, I just don't believe that that's the way to go. I think that's a flawed approach to any film festival.
Yeah, especially when the stats show that 70 to 75% of the directors currently working in the industry are male. Mm-hmm. So chances are that a 50-50 split in quality is not really going to happen, per se. And I mean, you know, Cannes only had 4 female directors in competition this year, and you know what? That was fine. I had no problem with there being only 4. Just mm-hmm. like I had no problem with there only being 2 female filmmakers in competition at Venice, because you know what? As Barbera said, he's in the game of choosing the best, not, you know,
yeah,
putting quotas left and right.
Mm.
You know, if the Kelly Reichardt movie was available, he would have chosen it. He's admitted to that.
Yeah.
But it wasn't available. Mm. So, and Kelly Reichardt is a world-class filmmaker. He's going to choose it. You know, he's not going to, it's not like Barbera's this sexist pig that doesn't want women to succeed.
if you read IndieWire and other people, that's exactly what he is, and that's the
I know, and
I don't know that that's a fair way to present it, but that's the way they are presenting it.
I know. I mean, you have to look at the female director, the marquee female directors, which have new movies this year, and you know. I think there wasn't that much to choose from, sadly. You know, as far as the marquee titles go, you know, you would have Marielle Heller, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Mm.
Kelly Reichardt.
Yeah.
Is another one. I'm trying to think of another big one.
You know, there's something about Kelly Reichardt's films that you can't not respect the clarity, the purity, the, you know, she will not bend to whatever commercial expectations you might think are required. But I've never been able to really feel great enthusiasm for her stuff, although I have a fear on some level that The First Cow is going to be another quote-unquote Kelly Reichardt film, but, you know, I shouldn't be negative about it, but I have a fear, just from the description, that sounds kind of McCabe and Mrs. Miller-ish, maybe, but without the tragic aspect, who knows, you know?
Yeah, it sounds like another Meeks cutoff.
Yeah, which was
basically this never-ending road trip.
Yeah,
via the Oregon Trail.
Right.
But here I have a list of female directed movies for this year's TIFF.
Mm.
And also, by the way, Marielle Heller's movie is not at Telluride, so.
But it will be at TIFF. Or I've forgotten. It is going to be a TIFF, yes?
It will be a TIFF.
Yeah, right.
TIFF. Right. I mean, I see this, and like a lot of these lists have Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which was a Cannes.
Yeah.
That'll probably be the top female directed movie of the year, I think.
Right.
Now. But right now, let's see. There's not much. There's Rocks by Sarah Gavron, who directed Suffragette. That'll be a TIFF.
Uh-huh. I love Suffragette, by the way. I really thought that was a good film. Really.
Yeah, I know. It's a real shame that it didn't really break out, because it had garnered really good reviews at Telluride.
Carey Mulligan was just... I loved her in that film. That was so great.
Yeah. So what we have here are movies that basically Telluride did not choose, like Harriet, like Hustlers, like Radioactive.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all directed by women, and they're not going to Telluride.
Uh-huh.
So I mean, the amount of female-directed movies that are being buzzed about this year, this fall, are sadly very limited to maybe, you know, four or five of them, and it's terrible. I'm saying it sucks, but it does, you know, correlate well with the stats that we have about there being 70% to 75% male directors in the industry. I mean, you can't escape those stats. You know, and it's up to a film festival like Sundance to groom new female filmmakers. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is their job with the Sundance Lab and then premiering their movies. That's why I have no problem with Sundance necessarily going a woke route, because they can do whatever they want. They have a vision of the future and how movies are supposed to be that is their own, and you know, you might not agree with it, but they're trying to change the way things are. But just don't expect this to leak into Cannes or Venice and for there to be a 50-50 split anytime soon. There's no way that'll happen. You know, people are just living in another reality, thinking that it'll be 50-50.
Right. All right. I guess I really can't promise to be able to talk things over or tell you about it. I would certainly like to talk things over when I get back, maybe on Tuesday or Wednesday of next week, if you want to do something then. And then that'll be. And then when do you leave for Toronto? Is that
I'm leaving on Wednesday, so we should do it on Tuesday.
Tuesday is fine. Let's do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to go see. By the way, the longer Midsommar on Tuesday when I get back. Are you going to see that this week, or do you care?
Oh, I really want to see that. Yeah, I really want to see the longer version because I hear it's much better. And it fills up a few plot holes, and it expands on some characters. I think there's half an hour of new footage.
Okay.
Which is quite insane. So now the movie is over 3 hours, I think.
Mm.
Or no, it's 2 hours and 57.
I have a screening this evening of It, by the way. Have you seen that yet? It Part 2?
No, I have not seen It Part 2, but the advanced word isn't good on this movie.
Were you a fan of the first one?
I thought it was watchable. It was well made, it was watchable. I don't really particularly think it's as great as its box office numbers make it out to be. But I know that we were both fans of Mama, which was Muschietti's first American movie.
That was made with kind of in collaboration with Guillermo del Toro, and when I saw that, Mama, I said to myself, "This is wonderful, man." I mean, because the movie was so full of intimations and hints of creepiness, and you know, it didn't ever explicitly push anything in your face, except at the end. I just thought it was so brilliant. And then Muschietti comes forward, and I thought, oh, great, we're going to have a little bit more of that. And he completely capitulated to what your low-class person wanting a low-class horror film, which is right in your face, and screaming and howling and all the climactic, you know, jizz whiz they like to throw into these films. And I thought, boy, this guy has just completely gone for the paycheck. He's just, you know, he's in a position to direct the big stuff, and that's the hell of it, you know. The things that he managed to do, he and Guillermo did in Mama, are not going to happen anymore. So.
You know, he's working on a 6-hour cut, which, or as he calls it, a super cut of both movies, which he would love to release.
You mean the first It and the second It, a 6-hour cut?
Yeah, he calls it
together.
Super cuts, and it's been making the rounds in the news.
Yeah.
He seems quite adamant in having this thing released. It'll all depend on how successful chapter two is at the box office, but a 6-hour cut of it is something I'll probably never watch.
Mm.
No, it's a real shame though, because he's a very talented guy, but basically with chapter one he was adhering to Joe and Jane Popcorn's cinematic tastes, which, you know, fairly safe, middle of the road. Few jump scares here and there.
Right.
And I hear this new one isn't really any better. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, let's definitely talk Tuesday, and maybe sometime in the I'll be in late. Maybe like noonish my time, 3 your time, something like that.
Okay.
You know.
Sounds good. I'm looking forward to your coverage. I would like to see what's the deal with some of these movies.
Yeah. All right, man.
Have a good one.
Have a good one.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.